The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas V. Gibbs is on the air.
Hello, my friends. Douglas V. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution. This is KPRZ, Mr. Constitution Hour, and it's available on all the podcast platforms. And in Article 1, Section 3 of the United States Constitution, the final clause of that section in the U.S. Constitution, it reads that judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. What that's saying is that the president has immunity. During his presidency, he may not be prosecuted. If he is to be prosecuted, it must be an impeachment. An impeachment is a political trial. And in the case of an impeachment, the worst punishment from an impeachment is removal from office and the inability to ever run for office again. Political trial. So while in office, the President of the United States is immune. He may not be criminally charged. This was to protect the president from his opposition, his enemies, to make up false charges, just go after him constantly so that he can't do his job. Now, unfortunately, if you have a criminally minded president, it also makes them immune from you going after them while they're committing all kinds of atrocities. Now, that said, the next part is the part that's important. Let me read it again. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. In other words, a president can be criminally charged for crimes committed while president of the United States. Those criminal charges while president of the United States, however, may not be proposed. He may not be indicted. They may not be charged on those items unless he was impeached and convicted of that impeachment for those exact same crimes while in office. Listen carefully, because it says the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and public to indictment. So, must be convicted of impeachment. So now we get back to President Trump. Can he be charged for things he did while president criminally? No, because he was not impeached and convicted of impeachment for those items. Now they're going after him with his business practices before he was president and all that. And while it's ridiculous, it's legal. But going after him for inciting insurrection, not so much. Now here's the question. So, insurrection is an overthrow of government. President Trump was president of the United States at the time. Someone within the system committing insurrection, rare, not normal. Second of all, what is the president's job? The president's job as president of the United States is to execute the laws of the Union. That includes election laws. And as the person charged with executing the laws of the Union, if he believes they are not being executed properly, it is his job to observe that, make sure it's known, and take action regarding it, which is what President Trump was doing regarding the 2020 election. He believed that election law was not being followed, that there was fraud or anomalies or irregularities or whatever you want to call it, and so he tried to bring attention to it and even tried to do something about it. That was his job. He was president of the United States. His job was to make sure the law is properly executed. So he wasn't committing insurrection. He was not inciting insurrection. he was carrying out the duties of President of the United States. So that's our opening salvo here on Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs here on KPRZ and all of those podcast channels that some of you listen on. But I want to get to the next part because this is also important. We've had in the courts a discussion. An example of this is Moore v. Harper, in which the North Carolina legislature redrew the congressional lines, and then the court said, nope, can't do it that way. They're basing it on the Voting Rights Act, but the question is, does the federal government even have the authority to pass a law regarding how a state draws its lines or does anything when it comes to its elections? Because, for example, it does say that the times places and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. So that's saying it's up to the state legislature. But there's the part that we have to also remember exists. But the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except as the places of choosing senators. So if they feel that what they're doing is tyrannical, Congress does have the authority to make law. So we question, is the Voting Rights Act legal? And we have to ask another question. Is it following the idea that states are supposed to be treated equally? In other words, are they allowing some states to redraw the lines but not others? Are they saying, yeah, you know, Massachusetts, no problem. You can do it any way you want, but North Carolina, we've got our eye on you. Well, the states are supposed to be treated equally. If the federal government is going to operate in its relationship with the states, then its relationship with the states needs to be the same. It cannot say that a state is expected to do one thing, but another state is expected to do something else. So we have a difficulty here. We have a federal government that are treating the states differently based on their ideology or based on their history. The southern states are treated more critically when it comes to what the federal government officials that are currently there would call a racist past. And they are then trying to adjust their treatment of them accordingly based on what they believe to be a racist past. Of course, that is then to assume that there is no change in anybody's attitude, that what they were is who they are, and if they are, then that means that racism never went away, and all these states are just a bunch of racist states anyway, because they used to be. So they must be. And of course, you know, as a Christian, we know that that's completely ridiculous. Times change, attitudes change, people grow, people become more in line with what Christ wants, so on and so forth. So there's questions there regarding our election. Should the federal government be involved? And while I do understand that in Article 1, Section 4, Congress is allowed to make changes to the election law if they feel it's necessary regarding Senate and House, if that, you'll also notice that's what it says. They can't regarding President of the United States, which brings us now back to something else, where they're trying to make law regarding the Electoral College, make law on how the electors are chosen, make law to change the system to a national popular vote. Well, wait a second. The Constitution, when it comes to the presidential election, only says that it's up to the state legislatures to choose how the electors are to determine how the electors are going to be chosen. That's it. Federal government has no mention in the Constitution regarding presidential elections whatsoever. No authority until it comes time to count the electors. And then at that time, the Vice President of the United States, as President of the Senate, is deemed with the or given the a task to count the electoral votes, and that's it. He's not there to certify the election. The word certify appears twice. And it is regarding the electors themselves when they place their votes in the envelope to send to Congress to be voted, or I'm sorry, to be counted by the President of the Senate. That is its certification. Decertify is not in the Constitution. That means that the decertification of any electoral votes then would be up to the states as per the 10th Amendment. Because the 10th Amendment basically says that if something is not given to the federal government as an authority and it's not prohibited to the states, then it's up to the states to take care of it. And none of that is being followed. None of that is being seen. We've got a federal government that thinks it's a national government and thinks it could do anything it wants. Why has this happened? Why is our country where it's at, where we have a federal government that acts like it's a national government, like the president is a ruler. You know, unless, of course, Trump is president, then, you know, he must be beaten down. He has no power. But if it's, you know, President Biden, then the federal government is to be followed at all costs. And the president is, you know, King Biden. How have we gotten there? Well, I'll answer that with a saying that I have. We can't get our political house in order if we don't get our religious house in order. If we're not right with God, none of the other stuff matters. If there is controversy in the church, which is history of our church, I mean, when, you know, Jesus Christ had been born and sacrificed on the cross, the people of Israel were divided over Christ. After his resurrection, the first sermon bearing witness to him arose because many of the Jews mocked the first outpouring of the Holy Spirit. The apostles so irritated the authorities that they were threatened. They were commanded not to preach about Christ anymore. When Paul and Barnabas visited Thessalonica, the Jews and pagans drew some believers before the magistrates with the bitter accusation that these men who have turned the world upside down and acting against the decrees of Caesar. So Christ and his people caused controversy in Israel and the Roman Empire. So, and we see that same internal controversy. We see the controversy also with the world today. And from the first extension of the gospel to the Gentiles, there was controversy over their inclusion also. And there were subsequent internal conflicts, which gave occasion for writing much of the New Testament. False teaching and other internal disagreements appeared. Christ himself controverted the practices of some churches. And so now that we look at the modern day church, and here's what we see, the same thing was going on then, is heresy after heresy has arisen. And there are some major schisms, even where heresy does not seem to have prevailed. We are battling ourselves. How can we turn this country around? How can we get things going in the right direction if we're not even in agreement with ourselves? Now, you know, Paul said there must be factions among you in order that those who are genuine among you may be recognized. 1 Corinthians 11:19. So controversy will be common. There will be factions. That is the truth of human nature. And Paul regarded that as an essential trait of elders, that they know how to avoid it where it was unprofitable. In other words, controversy is a wonderful thing. Factions is a wonderful thing. The battling out and making compromise is a good thing, as long as those differences of opinions are not unprofitable. It must be profitable. It must be good for the church. If it's not good for the growth of the church, it's not good for the growth of the society and the culture, then it needs to be discarded. So what I'm saying is controversy is inevitable. God has given us instructions on how to handle it. If someone controverts sound doctrine and stirs up division and will not repent when rebuked, he is to be avoided. The scripture provides for much stricter discipline if we are inclined to imagine. 2 John verse 10 says that we are not even to greet false teachers. 1 Corinthians 5:11 says to not even eat with anyone who professes faith and is guilty of certain severe moral faults. And Christ says that those who refuse to repent private offenses are to be regarded as outside the church. Matthew 18:15-17. These things being so, how much more worthy of avoidance are those that stubbornly promote false doctrine or commit scandal before the whole world? Yet we are content with that today. We seem to have accepted and even allow false doctrine, even in our own churches. But when this controversy has become so common that the response is, don't worry about it, it is what it is. The evangelical community, the Christian community, we are in controversy. We are generating controversy a lot because we are allowing the social pressure being put on the church by a worldly people out there that don't know Christ to have their influences and to create such controversy. And, you know, it's a tough thing to watch. The church is not merely an institution represented in some formal ecclesiastical bodies that is just a gathering. This is the communion of saints. This is us having fellowship with each other and coming together in the eyes of the Lord so that we may profess to the world what the truth is. So if we can't even figure out the truth because we're battling within ourselves, then what good is the church? So we better clean the church up. Once again, now I got to go back to what I said earlier. How can we get our political house in order if we can't even get our religious house in order? And the problem is the people out there that are battling within the church, the institutional church, the evangelical church, the Protestant churches, the Catholic church, all of that. We have turned a blind eye to what the churches are actually experiencing at present. Now, people who react to public wrong on the part of people in the evangelical community by avoiding said people, canceling their invites, conferences, and programs on the radio, refusing to listen to them, etc., are simply doing what God commands in those verses which I mentioned earlier. And so we are expected, and that's what we're expected to do. But we're being told that that's wrong, that that's causing scandal. Why would we give credence to those false teachings, to false teachers? I mean, we must operate based on God's ordained processes for dealing with offenders, as revealed in Scripture. The church's extra scriptural processes for doing so is what some of us do. We avoid, it's an old saying, and let me back up here. There's an old saying, you can't reason with the unreasonable. And you don't break bread with the unreasonable. You don't talk to the unreasonable. If they're not willing to be reasonable, you preach to them, you try to get the word to them, but you don't hang out with them. They are not your friends. They are outside the church. This is not to say that we are not to go outside the church and into the trenches for the Great Commission. We are to share the gospel. We are to share the good news of Christ to everyone who's willing to listen, and maybe some of those who aren't. And that is our job as Christians. But that doesn't mean that you invite the unreasonable into your house and then you sit down with the unreasonable and you allow them to spew all of their ridiculousness at you. If they're not willing to listen, if they're not willing to stop for just a moment to hear what you have to say because their worldly ideas, their worldly influences, their worldly convictions are more important to them than ever listening to what you have to say, and they spit upon you in the process. They say things like, you are their enemy. They will destroy you or whatever. Then have nothing to do with them. Don't break bread with them. Do not spend the time with them. They are not your friend. They are not your fellow Christian warrior. And I know it's a difficult thing to digest here. But, I've watched as the denominations are being infiltrated. Presbyterian Church, the Southern Baptist Church, Catholicism long ago, they began to be infiltrated. And some people, what they've done is they've decided to leave the denomination rather than fight to change it, and that may be the right thing to do. Because that denomination might not be capable anymore or willing to meaningfully restrain or punish wrong in their midst, or to correct their course. If they're not willing to correct their course, if the Word of God is presented to them and they continue to move in a worldly direction, then people leaving the denomination or the church that they are a member of, then is what you need to do. This does not create our anarchy. It separates us from the anarchy of the endless controversy that's going on within that church, or within the people of your lives that follow such worldly teachings. So we have been given by Christ and by the Bible the policies, the plan on how to resolve controversy and how to separate ourselves from controversy if necessary. That's what we're supposed to do. yet we have 1 foot in the world and 1 foot in the church, and we party and we break bread with all of these worldly minds, and we allow our church to be influenced by this, and we got our churches now flying all these six color rainbow flags, and letting the rule of man overpower the rule of law. And as a Christian, is that what we're supposed to be doing? Is that our place? You know, it's interesting because the church and its convoluted extra-scriptural judicial processes over the church that's not in line with what was originally intended, what we're watching, it breaks the heart. It is a part of what happens. It is a part of human nature. This and this recent advocacy of sin in the church is nothing new. We've seen it before, but we've not seen it as widespread as this before. And we're losing our church. And, you know, it's funny because people don't realize how important that is. So Benjamin Franklin, and this is one of my favorite quotes by different founding fathers. So Benjamin Franklin said, "Only if virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters." And George Washington said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." In other words, if we don't have, if we're not right in the church, if we don't have our faith headed in the right direction and pointing in the right direction, then liberty dies. The country is not capable of moving forward. So when we talk about what's going on in the church and how we justify behavior that is not within God's commands, not within natural living and so on and so forth, we are removing the church and its virtuousness from the culture. Now, without the church and its virtue in the culture and promoting a standard set of morality, a standard compass, moral compass, if that's not there, then what's going to happen is there is confusion. There is moral confusion in the world, and the world will do what the world does. It will follow human nature, and it will go awry. It will chase after all of these ridiculous ideas, these different behaviors, these deviations. Because there's no standard. Because the church removed itself to fight among itself. We're so busy battling each other that we have literally tainted and removed the moral standard from culture. What do you think is going to happen? What did we think was going to happen when the culture becomes drained of the moral standard? God's moral standard. You know, I read a lot of history, and Cicero was a statesman in the Roman Republic right before it went from republic to empire. And one of his concerns was that the moral traditions of Rome were being lost about the time it became an empire. When you remove God, tyranny and death replaces it or him. French Revolution is another good example. The American Revolution versus the French Revolution. The American Revolution was God-based, scripturally based, and based on individualism. The French, while they had a revolution very similar, they removed individualism, and they sought a secular system. Because the established church had them so mad, they figured they would just get rid of religion altogether. But by completely removing religion, what they wind up with? The Reign of Terror. Hundreds beheaded and killed. Thousands beheaded and killed. The Reign of Terror in particular was about 250 people that if they disagreed with them, they just pulled them out of their homes and they beheaded them. And then they went from a monarch, King Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, to the terror of the revolution. And then they fell in the hands of a dictator, Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte. So you remove God from the equation and individualism from the equation, you get the French Revolution, not the American Revolution. You get tyranny. You get a system that is unchristlike, that is dangerous, that is dictatorial, that is authoritarian, and that is willing to kill people for daring to disagree. So that's what we're facing. So once again, people ask me all the time, well, Doug, what do we do? You know, we're watching this, everything go wrong. What do we do to fix it? And I tell people, we get right with God. If we are not standing on the proper foundation in the first place, the foundation is broken and there's no way we can defend it. If we don't have a proper foundation, and if we have not built a proper structure around, and on top of that foundation and around us, then we are standing naked in the middle of the woods. And all of the fighting, all of the protesting, all of the rallying in the world is not going to change anything. We better get right with God first. We better have that foundation. I spent many years struggling sometimes with this stuff. Everybody does. But when you finally come to that point, you realize the only way to turn things around is the godly direction. All right, I'm going to take a short break. When I come back, we've got some news and stuff to talk about. I'll keep the Constitution sort of involved, but I've got some news items I want to talk about in the second half of the program, so don't go anywhere.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled. You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
Hi, this is Douglas V. Gibbs, advocate for restoring the Constitutional Republic and host of the Mr. Constitution Hour on K-Praise, San Diego, 9 p.m. Saturdays. Attacks against liberty around the world are increasing. The enemies of liberty have infiltrated the halls of government, and they have conquered every institution we need to restore the biblical and constitutional foundation of America. Leftism is putting the squeeze on our liberty and personal well-being. It's not hopeless. I have been planting strategy, information, and establishing tactical hubs around America. Faith, education, advocacy, restoration. Check out my books, including my latest, Repeal Democracy. Listen to the Mr. Constitution Hour on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. on K-Praise and become a $9 per month patron at douglasvgibbs.com. Help fuel the movement that has the anti-liberty left on the run. Go to douglasvgibbs.com. Click join, click patron, become a member of the movement. Let's work together on the strategies to save America. douglasvgibbs.com. Repeal Democracy by Douglas V. Gibbs is finally available. Doug's latest book examines the importance of being a republic, how we can restore a republic, and why democracy is so dangerous. Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. C.S. Lewis. And that is the very first page that you will see right before Chapter 1 in Repeal Democracy. Repeal Democracy by Douglas V. Gibbs. On sale now. All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. Okay, welcome back, Mr. Constitution Hour by Douglas V. Gibbs here on KPRZ, AM 1210 in San Diego, and all over the podcast networks. We are on Audible and Odyssey and Spotify and iHeartRadio and Amazon Prime, and the list goes on and on and on. I think it was like 12 or 13 podcast channels that this show broadcasts on. So if you're listening in that manner, thank you for being here. Don't forget to go to douglasvgibbs.com, douglasvgibbs.com. I'm getting ready to start a new video regimen. I've got a new book getting ready to come out. So you heard the ad for Repeal Democracy. That was from a little over a year ago. That book has done really well. I've got a history book. I've got a book of the presidents. And I've got a book regarding the Biden regime, all coming out really soon. The history book first, probably within the next few days, should be available on Amazon. Have an availability in my store, maybe a few weeks away. And, of course, I'll have them with me live if you know me and want to meet with me here in Southern California at an event or at a class. But if you want to buy it on Amazon, that's fine. So the name of the book is A Promise of Truth Self-Evident, Part 1, U.S. History, or Early American History, actually. And it's about a 700-page book. Got that one coming out any day now. In about the next 2 or 3 weeks, I should have my Mr. Constitution's Book of Presidents. And in about 4, 5, maybe 6 weeks, we'll have the Biden's Crimes and Family Secrets. So we've got 3 books back to back to back coming out. And the most recent one, or the newest one, coming up within days on Amazon to be available. A Promise of Truth Self-Evident by Douglas V. Gibbs. So be on the lookout for that, Part 1, American History, Early American History. Okay, now, let's talk a little news. So in the news, this is the headline from a website that, one of the many websites I visit, and this one is called WLT Report. And the headline is, Congress spent 3 times more on Ukraine than the Southern Border Protection. So all this money is going to Ukraine to fight against Russia, because poor Ukraine has been attacked by Russia. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that the Russian people should not be defended. Or, I'm sorry, the Ukrainian people. The Russian people, the Ukrainian people are not the problem. The regimes are the problem, first of all. So let's first of all put that up front. The people should be defended and should not be facing what they're facing, be it on the Ukrainian side, the Russian side, or anywhere else. What we have here is a problem with regimes. So you have the Ukrainian government, which is probably among, if not the most, corrupt system in the world. And you have Russia being led by Vladimir Putin, who is a former KGB guy. And some might even say he's a hardline communist. I don't know if that's necessarily the truth, but that's what a lot of people might say. And you've got Russia saying Ukraine's not a real country, and there are regions in the Ukraine that speak Russian. They are loyal to Russia. They belong to Russia. They should be a part of Russia. And we're there just to protect those people. Of course, that's what Nazi Germany did. Say, hey, you know, we've got German-speaking people in Poland and Czechoslovakia and Austria. We need to protect them, so we're going to invade it. So, historically, what Russia has done moving against Ukraine is not a good thing. But the thing is, the problem is, we have, now remember, there are ideological battles going on, right? The battle of the factions. And we have a left-wing Democrat Party who, in a past election, 2020, said, hey, our enemy, Russia, of course, they loved Russia when it was still communist, part of the Soviet Union. Then the Democrats were doing whatever they could to align with them, work with them, and negotiate with them. But now that communism's gone, they are the great enemy. China, of course, is just a footnote set aside by them when China is a greater enemy than Russia could ever be at this moment. That's beside the point. And so the narrative was that Russia and Trump were colluding with each other and that there was Russian interference in the 2020 election to try to get Trump elected. Trump was the favored candidate by Putin and Russia. And he was colluding with the Russians. He's part of the enemy team. And they pushed that narrative, even though it's been proven to be false. The paperwork, the reports that had been, they were all manufactured by the Democratic Party. None of it was true. The dossier, the Russia dossier, the Obama dossier, was full of garbage. And that's been proven. But the latest revelation to come out of this is very interesting. Turns out that Obama's CIA honcho, John Brennan, doctored, more so than we thought, the critical January 2017 intelligence community assessment report to make it appear that Vladimir Putin favored Trump for the presidency in 2016. Some independent journalists contend that the CIA is currently hiding right now at its headquarters, a 50-page report asserting the opposite. And that, in other words, the truth is, after they did their research, that Putin favored Hillary. Putin wanted the Democrats to be in power. Of course he did. Because the Democrats lean closer to communism than the Republicans do. President Barack Obama commissioned the ICA, this report, in December 2016. On January 6th, 2017, a day that will live in infamy, the conspirators released the declassified version. This was Brennan's way of welcoming the president-elect to Washington. Titled Assessing Russian Activities and Intentions in Recent U.S. Elections, the report concluded that Putin ordered an influence campaign, the goal of which was to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. In other words, the Russians were tampering with and causing fraud in relation to the 2020 election to make sure Trump got elected. The reality is it was the opposite. A, Russia wanted Hillary to win. B, the influence, the illegal influence, the fraud was not being committed by Russia and not being committed on behalf of Trump. It was being committed by the Democrat Party on behalf of Hillary and all of the other Democrat yahoos. The Obama dossier, as Representative Devin Nunes called the ICA, was so much garbage in a clear plastic bag. It reads like a college term paper filled with sundry bits of information gathered from here and there just hours before the due date, thrown together to make it look like, try to make it look like Russia, 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 when in reality it was full of shortcomings. It failed to provide a credible rationale for Putin to disfavor Hillary Clinton so vehemently. According to the ICA, Putin publicly blamed her since 2011 for inciting mass protests against his regime and holds a grudge for comments he almost certainly saw as disparaging him. The ICA does not mention Hillary's more than compensatory assets, like the role she and her husband Bill played in facilitating the sale of Uranium One to Rosatom, the entity that controlled all things nuclear in Russia, including the arsenal. In other words, uranium, the material needed to create nuclear weapons, was sold to, given to Russia. That was conveniently left out, that the Clintons facilitated that. That was not in the report. How is it he despised her so much, Putin, I mean, if she was the one making sure they were getting all the uranium they needed? Many of the report's assertions were made with evidence no more convincing than that which tied Putin to Trump, including some in boldface, such as Putin ordered campaign to influence U.S. election, or the influence effort was boldest yet in the U.S. Lacking human intelligence in the Kremlin, the report writers had no idea what Putin did or did not order. They conceded that beginning in June 2016, Putin ceased directly praising President-elect Trump for the probable reason that any praise from Putin personally would backfire in the United States. Unaddressed is why Putin showed such discretion in this regard, and yet authorized a multifaceted campaign so clumsy that it damaged Trump's campaign and almost destroyed his presidency. Much of the ICA, the Obama dossier, as Nunes likes to call it, bordered on irrelevance. If Russia's primary television network, RT, favored Trump, it sure wasn't looking like it, it sure didn't act like it, it sure was not programming in that manner, and it had less influence than the BBC or the scores of other networks, foreign or domestic, that favored Hillary. The various trolls and bots on social media, if actually Russian origin, had even less influence. And then, as we've learned from the Hamilton 68 controversy, was that those bots, those persons in the social media being accused of being Russian bots, were actually conservative members of social media. In other words, they were identifying legitimate conservative Trump supporters as being Russian bots in social media. In other words, it was a big lie. Of course, it's all a lie. We have a citizenry that falls for this stuff, line, hook, and sinker. They fall for it, and then they think they know everything. The various trolls and bots on social media were not Russian in origin. It was all a game. It was all a production, just like everything that the left does. The Democrats are really good at productions. Well, they and Hollywood are hand in hand, are they not? So they create these productions. They create the production of Russia, Russia, Russia with the dossier. They create a production of insurrection with January 6th. It wasn't what they made it to look like. It was a production. This is what they do. And these desultory strands of information mostly just took up space in the assessment, much more space than one facet of Putin's influence campaign that actually merited the interest of the intelligence community in cyber operations. In July 2015, reported the ICA, Russian intelligence gained access to Democratic National Committee networks and maintained that access until at least June 2016. The report writers claimed that the GRU, the intelligence arm of the Russian military, hacked data from the DNC and senior Democratic officials and relayed it to WikiLeaks for publication. Julian Assange then is completely under now scrutiny, even though that is wrong in its own right. He's revealing the truth and he's attacked for it. The evidence for the hacking claim was much sketchier than the public had been led to believe. One reason the report spent so much pointless time on RT's programming and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's past was to compensate for the absence of real truth. An assessment of attribution usually is not a simple statement of who conducted an operation, the ICA insisted, but rather a series of judgments that describe whether it was an isolated incident, who was the likely perpetrator, that perpetrator's possible motivations, and whether a foreign government had a role in ordering or leading the operation, unquote. This was a long-winded way of saying that there was no DNA, there was no cyber fingerprints left behind. There was nothing left behind that could show what they were saying. It was all a false flag. There was no evidence whatsoever that Putin interfered with the election, that Russia interfered with the election, or that Russia wanted anything to do with a Trump win. None. Yet, there's evidence he wanted Hillary to win. It raises the question on who's making these judgments then. Who is making these decisions if there's no evidence? Then where is the Russia, Russia, Russia idea or the Trump is a dictator, a fascist, and all that? Where is that coming from? Who's making these judgments? John Brennan? Peter Strzok? James Comey from the FBI? Robert Mueller? And Robert Mueller would indict a dozen Russians for interference only because He knew they would never show up in court. It was a production, once again. It was an act, and people fall for it. People hear what the left puts out, and they fall for it. They believe it. They swear by it. And there's no evidence. The evidence was not there to convict them. He declined, however, to indict Assange. Assange would have shown up. Why did he not indict Assange? Because Assange knew the truth. He was simply a scapegoat. He was basically only someone to throw darts at and to blame so that it looked like they had evidence, so it looked like they had this big giant problem with Trump and the Russians. And it was all a lie. It was all a production. Undermining the whole study was one extraordinary failure by the FBI. The Bureau did not examine the servers the Russians allegedly hacked. If they hacked the DNC servers, then why was not the evidence examined? Because there was no evidence. It was basically, once again, just, we're going to throw it out there, hearsay, but it's fact. We're going to say it, but you're going to take it as fact. We're not going to show you any evidence, but you're going to believe it to be fact, and most Americans have. Most Americans have fallen for this garbage. The ICA concealed the fact that the servers were never, ever investigated. The truth came to light in a public feud between the DNC and the FBI. The FBI never requested access to the DNC's computer servers. Eric Walker, the DNC's deputy communications director, emphatically told BuzzFeed in an email 2 days before the ICA was released. The FBI insisted otherwise. A day later, a senior FBI official fired back. The FBI repeatedly stressed to DNC officials the necessity of obtaining direct access to servers and data, only to be rebuffed until well after the initial compromise had been mitigated. If DNC staffers repeatedly rebuffed the FBI, they may well have had something to hide, starting with the fact that the pilfering of data was likely an inside job. In other words, the data that was being exposed was not being done by the Russians, but by a Democrat on the inside, which means the whole Russia hoax was not only did Russia have nothing to do with, it was orchestrated and produced and carried out by the Democrat Party, or at least persons within the Democratic Party. This was a dispute that needed airing, but the drive-by media, the mainstream knuckleheads, just drove by. They had a conspiracy to peddle. They had a conspiracy to keep going, to keep feeding. They weren't going to come out and talk about it with the truth, because the hoax, the production needed to be held up. People needed to believe that Donald J. Trump was the bad guy and he was working with the Russians, regardless of the truth. The facts did not matter. The lack of investigation did not matter. The whole production did not matter, as long as, in the end, the only part that mattered was that the American people believed their lie. That's all that mattered. This is not over. It's still being looked into. It's still being investigated. Those independent investigators, journalists I mentioned earlier, Schellenberger and Taibbi, and I'm hoping that they can nail down these conspirators, that they get to the truth. And I'm hoping that Julian Assange also receives his day soon to be able to talk about the truth. Because the thing is, we have a government now under the Democrats that is not only working with the enemy China and still trying to claim that Trump is the enemy, but they're doing things like giving Hamas money after they murder 1,200 Israelis. It has been clear for quite some time that the Biden regime, despite its verbal show of support for Israel, is really on the side of Hamas. 1,200 Israelis were killed on October 7th, 2023, and in response to that, $10 billion in frozen funds is being given to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hamas's primary financier. And that followed $100 million in humanitarian aid, and it was labeled COVID aid, to Gaza and the West Bank on October 18th, less than 2 weeks after the massacre. Biden huffed and puffed about how that $100 million better not end up in the hands of Hamas, but he knew exactly that was exactly where it's going to wind up, and that is exactly where it wound up. And if all of this wasn't bad enough, the Biden regime is planning to follow it with the worst betrayal of all of our most loyal ally in the Middle East, Israel. The Washington Post reported Wednesday that Egypt, Jordan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates and Palestinian representatives, in addition to the United States, were rushing to complete a detailed, comprehensive plan for long-term peace between Israel and Palestinians, including a firm timeline for the establishment of a Palestinian state that could be announced as early as the next several weeks. As you may have noticed, the one concerned party that would likely lose territory if any state was established is Israel. You establish a Palestinian state, you are basically giving credence to the argument that Israel must be destroyed, and you're giving ground to the Islamic regimes that wish it to happen. Israel, according to Netanyahu, outright rejects international dictates regarding a permanent arrangement with the Palestinians. Such an arrangement will be reached only through direct negotiations between the parties without preconditions. But the Biden regime is doing everything they can to work with Muslim Arab nations to establish the Palestinian state and to basically stab Israel in the back. Netanyahu is very clear on this, and I applaud him for his firmness on this. He said Israel will continue to oppose the unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state. Such recognition in the wake of October 7 massacre would give a huge reward to unprecedented terrorism and prevent any future peace settlement. Hamas has behaved with appalling savagery, yet they are more popular than ever. The world is turning against liberty, against Israel, and against God. And the Democrats are welcoming it, they're ushering it, they are applauding it. All right, we're out of time. I need to go. Thanks for spending the time with me. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. Remember, DouglasVGibbs.com. Become a patron. Hit the join link in the link bar, a little star next to the word join. Join is in all caps. $9 a month helps fund what I do. And down the road, there will be some exclusionary items available to patron members. We're getting ready to start a new video campaign. I'm going to start blogging more again. I've got some stories, though, that you may have missed. For example, a little bit about what I talked about today, about when it comes to whether or not a president has immunity. So DouglasVGibbs.com, DouglasVGibbs.com, DouglasVGibbs.com. I am Mr. Constitution Douglas V. Gibbs. Thank you for spending the time with me. God bless, and we'll see you next time.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.